COVID-19 and kids, plus restaurants slowly return to work. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. A half dozen South Florida children are being treated for an illness linked with coronavirus. The CDC warns multi-system inflammatory syndrome can begin weeks after a child is infected with COVID-19. It is considered rare. So what's the latest about this condition? As the South Florida economy begins reopening, people going back to work, what do parents and caregivers need to know about kids and the virus? Plus, have you returned to a restaurant? Many are seating guests in dining rooms and outdoor tables again, so what precautions are they taking for their customers and employees? Do you have a reservation for this holiday weekend? Share your story with us on the South Florida Roundup next, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week, and thanks for supporting public radio. The reopening of South Florida is expanding. Beaches in Miami-Dade may open on June 1st, according to a statement released today on this Friday as we're live on the program. The statement coming from County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. It's also the date the county hopes to allow hotels to more fully reopen and accept regular guests. Now, later on in this program this hour, we're going to talk about the reopening of restaurants across the region. Have you returned to your favorite diner, your favorite restaurant? Do you have a reservation maybe over the holiday weekend? Let us know. Share your experiences, what you saw, what you ate, maybe your concerns as you're going out again. 800-743-WLRN. That's our telephone here as we're live on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. But first this hour, COVID-19 and children. Half a dozen kids are being treated in South Florida for a rare condition. It appears to be linked to the coronavirus. So let's get the latest on this with Dr. Barry Gelman, Chief Medical Officer at Holtz Children's Hospital, part of the Jackson Health System in Miami. And with us via FaceTime audio is Dr. Ronald Ford, Chief Medical Officer at the Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital, part of Memorial Healthcare System in Broward County. To the doctors, thank you very much for your time and sharing your expertise with us and our audience. Lots of concerns around kids and COVID and this syndrome here developing. Dr. Gelman, what do we know about this rare condition? It's called multi-system inflammatory syndrome. How do you describe it?
Great, Tom. I always enjoy your show. Thank you very much for inviting me. The official name is the Multisystem Inflammatory Syndrome of Children, so it's abbreviated as MISC, associated with COVID-19. Hmm. This actually was newly defined on May the 14th, so we're talking about something that received the formal definition by the CDC just a week ago. It is an inflammatory condition that children are presenting with. Mostly, we believe, after they have been infected with and recovered from COVID, but some are concomitantly infected. And the presentations are variable, but there are some patterns that we've been able to discern. And we were lucky in South Florida because we were getting information first from the UK and from Italy, where these were described earlier, and then from colleagues across the country. So the children present invariably with fever. So one of the criteria in the definition is fever for more than 24 hours. A host of other system involvement. So that could be skin. So example, a rash or conjunctivitis, irritation of the eyes. There could be mucositis. So inflammation of the tongue or the lips, and then some of these patients go on to develop serious heart condition, heart failure, or abnormalities of the coronary arteries, the arteries that supply blood to the heart. So it's called multi-system because there's the fever, and then there are different organs that are involved, and then the last category of criteria are there are markers that we can see from blood tests that show inflammation. So when a child has the fever for 24 hours, has multiple body systems that are involved, and has these inflammatory markers, then by definition, they have, and they were exposed to or recovering from COVID, then they meet the criteria.
Are they tested for the antibodies normally?
For the COVID-19? When a facility has the capability to do that, that is very important. Those tests are limited in some settings. But yes, because we believe that this is a post-infectious inflammatory condition that's occurring when the patients are recovering or have recovered, that's an important piece of information to know that there's antibody against the virus.
Dr. Gelman at Holt Children's, are you treating any of those kids with this syndrome?
We have treated two so far, and we've released some of that information to the media.
Yeah. Do they remain hospitalized?
One is still hospitalized, and one was actually discharged in very good condition.
Interesting. Dr. Ronald Ford is also with us. Dr. Gelman, you're probably familiar with Dr. Ford. He's chief medical officer at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital, just north of you.
Yes.
Dr. Ford, thank you for your time. You're with us via FaceTime audio. Have you treated any of these children coming down with this syndrome at DiMaggio?
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me. Yes, we've had a couple patients hospitalized with the syndrome that Dr. Gelman very well described. Both of the patients that were confirmed to have this were treated successfully and did very well. We've had a couple other patients who have presented where we have suspected that they have this, but have not yet been able to confirm the diagnosis.
The two that you have confirmed the diagnosis, are they still hospitalized at DiMaggio?
No.
They've both been discharged.
Both discharged in very good condition.
What can you tell us about the length of hospitalization and the treatment supplied?
I can't be terribly specific, but I can tell you that both patients were hospitalized for less than a week. We approached this, the treatment, similar to how we approach a disease called Kawasaki disease, which is something that we're very familiar in treating in children. It's also an inflammatory process, and this new disease has a lot of similarities to it. And so our initial approach has been to manage these kids like we would with Kawasaki, that had Kawasaki disease. But we're still learning. Every day we get new information from our colleagues locally and from our colleagues across the country about what they're finding is working and what has been less successful. And we're, as a nation, we're pulling together our information and our experience and learning from each other each day so we can design a treatment regimen that we think is going to be the best as we move forward.
What seems to be showing those early signs of success at DiMaggio with the two cases that have been released? And then Dr. Gelman, same question for you for Holtz with the one patient who has been sent home.
So we put together a team of experts from different specialties to decide on how we were going to approach patients with this. We did this several weeks ago, and the consensus was that we would, if they had this Kawasaki-like appearance to them, that we would treat them with IVIG, which is pooled antibodies, intravenous gamma globulin, as a first line treatment. Again, we had some data from the UK and from the New York cohort that showed some promise. Again, there's still not enough information to know that that's going to be the answer for all patients with this, but it did show some success in the patients that we had.
Dr. Gelman, what can you share about the course of treatment that was prescribed at Holtz?
Yeah, I would agree with what Ron just said. Absolutely. And I think that there is pretty good consensus nationwide and in many parts of the world about how we're going to approach this condition, even though we still have a lot to learn. And the consensus is that because this is an inflammatory condition, we would treat it with different anti-inflammatory medications or mechanisms to sort of tone down the immune system. So we've done similar things with intravenous immune globulin and some small doses of corticosteroid. Our one patient did well, and our second patient is recovering well, although that one did have significant heart disease. So what I would also add to what Ron said is the multidisciplinary approach is critical because, as I said, this is a multi-system disease. So kids can have heart disease, and kids can have skin manifestations, and kids can have GI manifestations. Both of our patients were in the intensive care unit, so the intensive care unit physicians are taking care of the patient. Mm. It's really important to get that expertise from the entire group and the entire team.
And again, I know we're going to be general talking about these patients, and there's very few of them, thankfully, but did all of those that have been treated at Hulse and DiMaggio, had they been exposed, at least exposed to COVID-19, did they test positive for the antibodies?
In our case, yes. So
yes, I would say the same for our cases.
Okay.
I was just going to add, when any patient meets these criteria and is admitted, we will test them with a PCR. That's the polymerase chain reaction, to test for the viral genetic material, right, to see if there's an active infection. Both of our patients actually had positive PCRs and had
so they had active infections. Infection. Yeah, yeah.
Curiously, ours did not test positive.
Yeah. But they did test positive for the antibodies at DiMaggio.
Correct.
That's what's been reported, is that many of them are after the acute infection and recovering and have antibody, but some are actively infected.
What's the age range that you doctors are experiencing locally, as well as what you're hearing from colleagues in New York and overseas in Europe?
The age range is pretty variable, especially as compared to, you know, Kawasaki's and some of the other similar type of things. I believe the youngest reported case has been 4 months of age, but we've seen it's been reported in teenagers as well as school age children, really children of all ages.
And is this, Dr. Gelman, viral or bacterial in nature?
We don't know. And in fact, we don't even have that answer for the Kawasaki syndrome. In fact, I've been telling our resident students here at Hulse and at the University of Miami that back when I was a pediatric resident, which is more than a couple of years ago, there was a theory about Kawasaki syndrome being caused by rug shampoos. I don't know if Ron's close enough to my age to remember this, but that actually was debunked. But we don't know what causes that syndrome, which is we believe it's a post-inflammatory syndrome, but there's no virus that's been identified. So here we know the virus, and it seems that there's a link, and it seems that it's post-inflammatory. But we don't have any reason to suspect that there's a different infectious agent that's causing this syndrome above and beyond the exposure to COVID and the inflammatory condition that for some reason is triggered.
Dr. Ford, is one of the questions among the many questions still to be answered is whether or not these children who are coming down with this syndrome would have experienced the syndrome without being exposed to COVID-19. Do we know if COVID-19 is a triggering mechanism of some kind?
Well, we think it is. And again, there's still a lot more to be learned. This is such a new disease that, you know, a lot of information continues to pour in from all over the world as people share their experiences. But what we do know is that the vast majority of these children have either tested positive, had an exposure, or have positive antibodies for it. So it seems to be a very close association.
We're talking about COVID-19 and children here in South Florida, talking about the rare and just a handful of cases, but important cases to begin learning about in regards to this new syndrome that has been identified, multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. We're speaking with Dr. Barry Gelman, Chief Medical Officer at Hulse Children's Hospital, part of Jackson Health System in Miami, and Dr. Ronald Ford, Chief Medical Officer at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital, part of Memorial Healthcare System. Your questions about kids and COVID-19 as we're just about to finish up the school year, summertime, really big questions there. And of course, the economy back reopening, maybe parents, caregivers, you have to go back to work. What are you going to do with kids? What does that look like over the summer? And protecting your children as we think about how and when to reopen schools. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. At this point, doctors, most healthcare providers have agreed that the risk for COVID-19 on kids was considered low or very low. Dr. Gelman, has that assessment for you changed at all given the handful of young patients experiencing this syndrome?
I would say no. what we can say with certainty, based on a lot of information from all over the world, is that the overwhelming majority of children will not become seriously ill from COVID. They may be asymptomatic, or they may have the symptoms of a cold or a mild flu with fever and a cough or a runny nose, and will recover. It appears that a very small subset of those children who are exposed to the virus will develop this syndrome. And even among the children all over the world who develop this syndrome, the overwhelming majority, have recovered. I mean, the number of deaths that have been reported from this syndrome is single digits in most of the groups that we're hearing about. So I think we still can say, well, we can certainly say that the profile for children is far less serious from the virus itself than it is for older adults.
Yeah. And Dr. Ford, how does that assessment go into the calculation and the public policy health debate that is ongoing, certainly regarding schools in this community, looking out in 3 months' time?
Well, the way I put the school reopening and COVID-19 together is that, you know, our goal is to minimize the transmission of this disease throughout our community. So children tend to be relatively mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic altogether. And so it's not always clear whether you have a child who is infected and can spread the disease based on their symptoms alone. So one of the important things that I think we're focused on is doing additional testing on these children to help understand where the virus actually is in our community and who can pass it on to other people, so that we take precautions through social distancing and through other measures to minimize its spread. So testing, I think, is really key in children now to be able to help us understand what their role is in the spread of this infection.
And that had not been a real priority in the early days and weeks, and even maybe a month and a half or so, where the testing was concentrated on first responders, understandably so, and concentrated on the most vulnerable, those with underlying health conditions and senior citizens. So as you see testing expanding into children, how do we get a better sense of what that information is telling us as a community, making decisions about going back to work for parents and caregivers, let alone going back to school potentially in the fall?
Yeah, it's similar to, you know, how we approach the adult problem of testing early on. You know, until we get enough information and find out how many kids have been infected or are infected and asymptomatic, it's going to be difficult to make some of these decisions until we have a lot more information related to that. So that's why I think we're really pushing for more testing in children moving forward, especially those children who have known exposures and may not be symptomatic, or those children who have mild symptoms. Because unless we know where this virus is and who can spread it and how to keep it contained, we're going to have difficulty throughout our entire community.
Yeah, and Dr. Gelman, it's an immediate question, because it's not just about school in the fall or even college campuses. It's about, you know, reopening offices and having parents and caregivers come back to work in kind of a collective way and interact with other adults only to come back home.
Yeah, it's very important information to have so that we can make smart public health decisions. And we don't have adequate access for testing of children. The chair of our department at the University of Miami, Dr. Judy Schechter, has been working with Dr. Rifke, the Surgeon General, and local agencies to see if we can expand the DOH sites to go down in age, because, as you said, many of them have been either high-risk populations or older adults or people who have been exposed, and cutting off at 18 years old or 14 years old. So, and the Surgeon General and the government have been supportive of that, so we're hoping that that happens so we can get more kids tested. And I would just add one other thing. The type of test is also important, because if we're doing testing for the virus, that's just a snapshot in time. So we can know that a child is not infected today, but then if they go to school, they can become infected. So that's why having much more robust antibody testing will be very important down the road.
And of course, that's true for anybody who gets the diagnostic test. It's that point in time to know whether or not you're infected right there when the swab is taken.
Correct.
And yeah. Thomas, if I may add that beginning Saturday, the CB Smith Park site is going to be open to all ages, including children. They will be able to be tested there free of charge. It's a drive-up service.
Any reservation needed?
A reservation is needed. I can give you, if parents go to the Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital website at jdch.com, the information is there on how to make a reservation. And we'll be starting off with screening children who are symptomatic, who have had a known exposure, or who have tested positive in the past and need to be retested. And then we plan to open it up to all children within the next 2 weeks.
That is CB Smith Park in Broward County beginning on Saturday. Is that right, Dr. Ford?
That's correct, yes. If they go to the Joe DiMaggio website, there's information there.
And details there about the reservation. Dr. Ronald Ford is the Chief Medical Officer at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital in Broward County. Dr. Ford, thanks for your opinion and sharing your expertise with us. Much appreciated.
I appreciate your time. Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Barry Gelman holds down the Chief Medical Officer position at the Holtz Children's Hospital, part of Jackson. Dr. Gelman, thank you for sharing your expertise with us and our audience today, too. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome.
We've got a lot more to talk about here in South Florida. The economy is beginning to reopen ever so slowly. As we mentioned at the top of our program on this Friday, Miami-Dade County is targeting June 1st for beaches to reopen. Restaurants are already starting to reopen across the region. What's that dining experience like during the pandemic? Share your experiences with us. 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576. Returning to the restaurants is next. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Reopening across the region continues. Broward and Miami-Dade counties began that process this week. Some businesses have been reopened for a couple of weeks now in Palm Beach County and the Florida Keys. Now, the most dramatic changes are being seen in restaurants. Under state and local regulations, restaurants are able to serve customers outdoors. Indoor dining is reopened again, but limited to 50% capacity. Folks who choose to dine in will notice many changes, probably. Tables are separated to avoid potential transmission of COVID-19. Social distancing is the rule. Hand sanitizer stations greet guests as they enter. Gloves and face masks, facial coverings are mandatory. So the new normal is here, certainly for the restaurant industry. What has been your experience if you've been out to eat over the last week, week and a half or so? Are you looking to make a reservation over the holiday weekend? Are you planning to avoid restaurants for the time being? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN for your experiences as the restaurant industry, an important one in South Florida for the economy, continues to reopen. Kevin Danilo is with us now on the telephone. He owns Batch Hospitality Group, overseeing three restaurants in Miami, Delray Beach, and West Palm Beach. Kevin, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
So are all three restaurants now open for an in-dining experience?
Not yet. So we got the thumbs up to open in West Palm on the 11th. So that was a week ago from Monday, but we only had about 3 days notice, and we didn't feel that was adequate timing. So we actually just opened up our Palm Beach locations, Delray and West Palm, on the 18th. And even though Miami-Dade, the mayor allowed openings on Monday, the 18th, the city of Miami was pushed to the 27th.
Right.
So we'll be opening our Miami location on the 27th, and then all three units will be back in action.
So Delray and West Palm are open right now for Batch Hospitality Group. It's been
that
less than
correct.
A week. What can you tell us about business? Has it returned in any noticeable way?
It's pretty much what we expected. It's really interesting to see how consumers are responding to this. And we weren't sure what was going to happen. Obviously, you have a section of the demographic that really wanted to get out, the people that wanted to be out and go to restaurants, either weren't fearful of it or thought that their precautions wouldn't be enough. And then you have people that, either are nervous to spend the money that they have or that they're still fearful of the disease. So you know, it's really interesting to see the mix. And we can see in the dining room, you have people that go out without masks, and then you have people that go out with gloves and a mask and are super careful. And the new norm is making sure that you're taking care of everybody safely and you respect everybody equally. So what we've seen is, you know, we're down about 30% from year over year, which is right in line with what we were thinking was going to happen. We got a nice pop the first 2 days that we were open. So on Monday and Tuesday, we got a huge delivery pop of our loyal regulars that hadn't been able to eat our food. We closed down for delivery and pickup throughout the process. So we were fully shut down. But we got a nice order from all the people that hadn't been in about 2 months. But this sustained business in-house is down about 30%.
Kevin, stick with us. We're going to talk more about the operations here in the new normal for Batch Hospitality Group. We're joined via FaceTime audio now by Monica Mika Leon. She owns Caja Caliente in Coral Gables. Mika, thanks for joining us here today. Appreciate your time. Mika,
thank you so much for having me today.
Sure thing. Is Caja Caliente open in Coral Gables?
We are to a certain capacity. We reopened following all protocol, the CDC and City of Coral Gables, on Wednesday morning.
And what was that? What was the preparation like for the dining room, for instance? Let's start there with just the physical space and what you had to do to accommodate the new regulations.
Well, I'll start by saying this is something, you know, that's new to all of us. So there is no guide. So, you know, it was just informing myself as best as I could. A lot of, you know, getting the staff ready, sanitizing, you know, definitely bringing in a lot of new things and expenses that, you know, we aren't used to on a daily basis. And, you know, we're kind of just going with the flow and, you know, doing our best with what we're being given.
Kevin, as you prepared to open your locations in Delray Beach and West Palm, did you get out the measuring stick to make sure the tables or the chairs were 6 feet apart from one another? What kind of preparations?
We absolutely do. Well, at first we thought we were going to be open at 25%. So we disassembled 75% of our tables. You know, we were working towards that 25% number, and then we got approval to get to 50%. So we put it back together. But yeah, you literally take out a tape measure. Your tables are facing an odd direction. You know, it's playing Jenga with a floor plan to make sure that you're safe and that the guests are going to be taken care of. You know, it is the new normal. There's no guide for it. A lot of this stuff is subjective. There's a lack of clarity on exactly what to do. Is it 6 feet from table to table, or is it 6 feet from where a guest is sitting in that chair to where the next guest is sitting in a chair? So really, you know, it comes down to the restaurant being responsible and doing what's in the best interest of the guest, and hoping that they see we're trying our best to do what's safe and going above and beyond, and you know, they reward us and show us some extra patronage because they know that we're doing everything we can to make sure that they have a safe, enjoyable dining experience.
We're talking about the restaurant reopenings here in South Florida with Kevin Danilo, who is the owner of Batch Hospitality Group, and Mika Leon owns Caja Caliente in Coral Gables. Have you been out eating, taking part in maybe the takeaway or the delivery business? Are you ready to get back in a seat or in a booth or at a high-top table at your favorite restaurant? 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. Mika, what was the staff preparation like as you prepared to open Caja Caliente over the last few days? What kind of training, formal training, did you do, and what kind of supplies did you have to go out and purchase?
Well, I mean, for us, we stayed open during the quarantine, takeout and delivery, as advised. You know, I'm grateful we did receive funding by the PPP, which allowed me to maintain my staff.
Yeah, so the Paycheck Protection Program from the federal government. Go ahead, though.
Correct. So that allowed me to keep my same staff, so I didn't have to go through the rehiring and retraining process, which we're very grateful for. But, you know, it was different. Again, I had to communicate one-on-ones with the staff, retraining when it came to sanitizing everything and cleaning protocol. Definitely a lot of confusion, a lot of questions. But again, it's just reinforcing and making sure and being on top of the employees to make sure that the customer's safety is our first priority.
Kevin, what was the retraining like for your crew? And as the dining room has come back at 50%, does that mean your payroll is back at 50%, or do you have to be fully staffed in order to kind of maintain the cleanliness and fulfill the regulatory obligations under this new normal?
Well, obviously, there's a labor curve where you gain efficiency over time. So running a busy restaurant is a lot easier than running a slow one. It's a lot more efficient. You have extra hands, and they can go where they need. So, you know, we do have extra labor hours per sales dollar, forecasted in what we're seeing in actuality. So there are extra people, and we have the staff to make sure that we're sanitizing and following all the extra steps. But long story short, yes, there's absolutely a lot more work that goes into serving a table today than it did 3 months ago.
And describe
those.
Training.
So we had a three-day training that we put together. We have a fantastic director of training. Even though we're three units, we have a great corporate team that we put together, and we put a focus on training. So the reason that we didn't open those Northern Two stores, or, you know, what we thought was going to happen was, you know, staff would be confused, that there would be a lot of procedures and guidances that are coming out that even just best practices that we wouldn't know about right away that we want to implement that, you know, it would take time to teach and train, that you can't just call on a staff and get them rolling right away. So the benefit of the people that were closed during the during the last couple of months, but did take out and delivery, they were able to live that. But because we closed fully, we had to get them back in and have those training wheels. We were going from pretty much everything was normal to it's a complete event. So we had to talk about the multiple steps of sanitizing tables and protection that everybody needs to wear and all the different procedures that are going into place to make sure that there's absolutely, 100% our best chance to make sure that, no virus is spread within our restaurant.
Yeah. Take us through those steps, Kevin. I'm curious. A three-day training seems pretty remarkable. That seems like a lot of training, 24 hours worth of training, if you figure 8 hours per day of that session, in order to make sure that the restaurant stays clean and, of course, that the workers remain protected. What was that like? What were some of those steps?
Yeah, so, it is a completely new day. So just for example, when you clear a table, we're not clearing tables unless the guests ask for it until the end of the dining experience, because what we found was a lot of guests don't want extra bodies coming up to their table. So we go to take an order and we go to drop off the food, but we're not going to stop by five different times to take off a plate. And if a guest, we talk to them about it, and a lot of it is communication and finding out what they want. So that's a big part of it is, do you want us to bring you tap water? Do you want, we're selling cheaper bottles of water, just, the no-name brand plastic bottles of water so that they're economical and we're not pranking the bank. And if somebody doesn't feel safe, we want to make sure that they have an option that's affordable. So, there's a lot of different steps that go into the dining experience now that never went into it before. For example, we sanitize a table when somebody gets up. And then we go by and we disinfect it with another chemical that sits on top of it and dries and fully disinfects the surface. And then a third time when a guest is sat, we go over with a disinfecting wipe and they can see us as we do it. So all those different steps are things that a host or a busboy or a server aren't used to. So it was role playing over and over and over again to make sure that they really understood this and that they followed the procedure. And even when you're wiping a table, we had, our busboys probably wiped the same table 15 times to coach them on, you got to grab the edges. You got to make sure that every square inch of it is clean. And when you disinfect, you got to make sure that the surface still has some liquid on it and it takes a minute or two to dry. So we can't reseat that table until it's fully disinfected for the guidelines of this chemical cleaning product.
Mika Leone, I'd like you to tap in here, Kevin. Sorry to interrupt, but I want to hear Mika's perspective on this, because so much of that, from a restaurateur's perspective, in the old normal was to not have that so visibly seen by the diner, right? You wanted the kind of cleaning and the bussing and the clearing and the setting of the table to kind of just happen in the background, so it didn't necessarily intersect with the guest's experience. Whereas now, Mika, I would imagine you probably want the diner to see all the steps that maybe you're going through in order to clean
the
tables. Yeah.
Part of our training, that is something that I told our staff. I was like, you guys have to show the customer everything that you guys are cleaning step by step. And to touch base again on what he was saying earlier, like, the thing is, I mean, we don't know what we're doing as much as, like, we're just following the guides. But, you know, it's about reiterating it to the staff. And whether it be disposable cups, disposable plates, disposable utensils, you know, I want to provide an experience to the guests, like they're eating out. But at the same time, I want to make sure that they feel safe. So, you know, now, you know, our servers are trained that they're telling the guests, would you like disposable or would you like real glass? And we're cleaning, we're putting it two cycles in the dishwasher. So again, coming back to the cost of staying open, we're at 100% payroll, like a normal operate, like a normal day of operating. And then on top of everything, you're taking on all these costs of sanitation and employees. So, you know, it's definitely different and more costly for sure.
And how are you kind of policing this as an owner and a manager? Have you deputized someone on staff that that double checks all the all the cleanliness? Yeah, Mika?
We definitely have checklists. And then as well, we are a family-owned business. My mom is there. My sister's there. We're on top of everything. You know, we have one location, so it's a little bit easier for us to delegate. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're there 18 hours a day. We're there from the moment we open to the moment we close. And we make it a point to, you know, talk to the customers, see what they like and what they don't. We even, the city of Coral Gables granted us to put a tent in our parking lot. So adjacent to our property, our parking lot, we put two 10 by 10 tents and some outdoor seating on the sidewalk, which was previously not allowed. Now they're permitting us to do that. So it's little changes like that, you know, that could help when it comes to, you know, serving more tables and making our guests feel more comfortable in an outdoor space.
Yeah. I know a number of communities are trying to make the kind of outdoor permitting process a lot more efficient and waive some of those regulations so that restaurants can increase their traffic, essentially, without increasing the density inside their dining rooms. Kevin, are you experiencing that with the batch restaurants?
Yeah. So fortunately, in Delray Beach, we have a giant outdoor patio, so it wasn't necessary. We're in a large plaza. But in West Palm, we're on Clematis Street, where obviously outdoor patio space is pretty rare. You know, everybody gets a couple tables and that's it. The DDA has been absolutely fantastic over there, and they have shut down the street. And they're actually providing the tables, chairs, umbrellas, and they actually went as far to staff service members who are going to go around and help sanitize and keep the area clear and clean. So that's been fantastic. Miami, we're at the ground floor of a hotel, so it's a little bit more tough there. We haven't gotten any word if the city's going to do anything for us over here.
Let me ask you about...
I don't know if it's feasible.
Let me ask both of you about facial coverings and for gloves. First, for your staff, are they required? Are they optional, Kevin, for your staff to wear masks, facial coverings, and gloves while serving?
You know, we made this a big point. It is absolutely required, and there's no putting it around just your chin and not your face. So, you know, at the end of the day, we told everybody it's like working at Disney World. And when you're in character and you're on staff and you're in the building, you need to wear them, whether you had it in the past or you sent them free or whatever it is.
And does that include the back of the room staff too, those folks in the kitchen?
Yep. 100%. So everybody in the restaurant will have gloves on all the time. Everybody will have a mask on all the time. If they're in the building, there's zero exceptions. They got to change those gloves out frequently. Hmm. That was something that was very important to us to make sure that everybody felt safe.
And Mika, how about for Caja Caliente in Coral Gables?
Absolutely. I mean, again, being open during quarantine, we kind of got a taste of what we should expect once the reopening did happen to the public. So we were a little bit more well-trained. Absolutely. Everybody has to be wearing a mask. And I honestly bought an insane amount of gloves when all of this started happening, because obviously they're changing their gloves a lot more.
Yeah.
Whenever you touch something, you have to change it. And, you know, it's challenging when you have a grill that's scorching hot and you're wearing a mask and a face covering, you know, but again, it's the new normal, and it's just something that we have to deal with for these times being.
And so what about for diners? Are you requiring diners to have to wear masks as they come into the dining room and essentially have a mask on except for the time when they're actually consuming the food?
Where that's where it gets a little bit tricky, and the customers are confused. And I think it really helped that we put posters up kind of explaining our protocol. We feel comfortable with, obviously, all our staff is masked. We feel comfortable if the guests are wearing a mask if they come indoors. Once you sit at your table, which is 6 feet from the other tables, then you can take off your mask. But also when they sit at the bar, then we do only have one employee with a face shield and a mask behind the bar.
So the bartender has a face shield on in addition to the mask.
Correct.
Yeah. And for patrons at the bar, are they required to wear a face mask, considering they're going to probably be sitting closer to one another as well as closer to your employee?
Well, my bar typically sits 12 people, and now it's gone down to six.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's 6 feet apart and only two parties of two at the bar. So, and, you know, I'm also losing a lot of real estate where I could be making profit. Yeah. So that's another thing.
Yeah. Kevin, how about for the customers at Batch? Are they turned away if they're not wearing a facial covering?
No, we haven't gone that far, and we wrestled with that, and I don't think there's a right answer. I think the strategy is very valid and intelligent. We didn't know what was right, if we could force people to do that or not. So we've been fortunate enough, and one of my biggest fears was how guests were going to react, were they going to be difficult, and what we've seen is guests have been very understanding, very kind, very compassionate towards both us as a business and to their peers. People are observing these 6 foot distances. They're not congregating in groups. We've been very lucky, and they're sticking to their tables. They're going in and they're getting out. And we're kind of more of a bar restaurant where mm-hmm. people come to have some fun too. So even though we match all the guidelines to reopen and we're a bona fide restaurant, you know, we had a fun Sunday brunch. We have people that come in late night, grab some cocktails. So it's a new norm not having the bar open and only sitting people at tables. We get in the biz crowd coming in after they get out of work, and they're sitting 6 feet apart from the next door restaurant that they're used to being buddy-buddy with. So fortunately, we've been lucky to see everybody observing the rules and really understanding the gravity of this. So I'm thankful for that. But who knows what's coming over the next 30 days.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that coming up. Kevin, stick with us. Kevin Danilo is owner of Batch Hospitality Group, owner of three restaurants in Miami, Delray Beach, and West Palm Beach. Two of them are open in Delray and West Palm. We've also got Mika Leon, owner of Caja Caliente Restaurant in Coral Gables. Mika, you stick with us as well. We want to talk more about the return of the restaurant industry as it begins to reopen. Your phone calls as well, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week and, of course, for supporting public radio. We're talking about the new normal in our region as the pandemic continues, the public health measures taken to limit the spread of COVID-19 and dealing with the economic consequences. Many restaurants and other businesses are reopening this week. The city of Miami and other municipalities are expected to enter that phase in the next week. Beaches in Miami-Dade County may reopen June 1st. Hotels may reopen for regular guests on June 1st as well. That's the target date that's being talked about here by county officials on this Friday as we're live on WLRN. Let's talk about restaurants. Have you gone out to eat at a restaurant? Have you taken part in the takeout? Now, are you looking to sit down back in your favorite dining room? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is our phone number. We're speaking with two South Florida restaurateurs. Kevin Danilo owns a Batch Hospitality Group. It has three restaurants in Delray Beach, Miami, and West Palm Beach. Delray and West Palm are open. Kevin expects to reopen Miami in the days ahead. And via FaceTime audio is Mika Leon, owner of Caja Caliente, a brick-and-mortar spot in Coral Gables. She remained open for takeout and delivery through the quarantine and has reopened the dining room and is also reopening, or rather opening up, a tent to expand her business for the time being. Mika, let me ask you, you mentioned you did receive the Paycheck Protection Program loan. It's a forgivable loan as long as you spend a certain amount of money and a certain amount of time on staff. Have you had to lay off any of the staff members with this quarantine?
So for, again, going back to that, we are a family-owned business, meaning that, you know, we can do a lot of the jobs ourselves. We chose to not get rid of the majority of the staff. Unfortunately, we did have to cut by half for a certain amount of time. We told them it was temporary. And the moment we got it approved for the PPP, I did bring them back on board. Whether it was to do their job or another job, I gave them the opportunity to come back to start making income again. And the way the PPP works is that, you know, 25% of the funds could be allocated towards rent and utilities, and the rest does have to be spent on payroll during a specific amount of time. If not, it's taken back. Or right. if you spend it on something else, it does convert into a loan at a very low interest rate, which is what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
Being that, you know,
let me ask you about that outlook here, because the money can be a forgivable loan, as you mentioned, if you spend 75% of it on payroll, but over 2 months, and the clock is ticking on those 2 months, depending upon when you received the loan money. So as you look beyond those 2 months, what does business look like for you, Mika?
Well, I had that conversation today with one of my peers. I think that's when we're really going to see what's going to happen to our industry. That's where we're going to see who's going to really get hit hard and who's going to survive the storm. I'm scared myself, you know, but, you know, staying positive again, staying open, being there for the customers. But yeah, it's just about watching your margins, you know, whether it be these delivery platforms that are taking a huge percentage of your sales. You know, we're trying to do our own delivery system to avoid that.
Yeah.
Wherever we could cut costs and, you know, increase our margins, you know, we really have to be thorough with that now more than ever.
Can I ask for you at Batch, did you apply for one of those paycheck loan programs?
Yes, we did. We were a part of the phase two. And
were you successful?
We were. And like Mika said, you don't want to take on additional loans right now. And, you know, their guidance is still up in the air with the forgiveness platform. A lot of people are fearful to use it. You know, a lot of people are fearful to apply for it. But at the end of the day, and a lot of people have come to me and spoken to me about it, and I think the government did a pretty damn good job with this thing. A lot of people are critical, and it's blue versus red and, you know, liberty versus security. There's so much up in the air, but everyone really came together in this platform. It is the largest spending bill in our history. You know, we got over $600 billion towards small business. And sure, there's some bad apples out there that used it inappropriately, and, you know, they'll loop the system. But I for sure can say that without the government's help, we would have been gone. We would
dead in
the water.
And there is an effort. The House of Representatives next week, after the Memorial Day holiday, is expected to vote on a bipartisan proposal that will extend kind of the forgivable nature of the Paycheck Protection Program, allowing businesses more time than just the 2 months to spend the money, because a lot of companies have come to the realization, and Mika, it sounds like you have as well, uncertainty is not returning in 2 months' time. There is still a lot of uncertainty about the regulations that have been put into place in the restaurant industry, specifically, Kevin, but also more generally about just consumer appetites to spend and to spend on hospitality. So how are you approaching, you know, the summer months even at Batch?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the hardest part is we literally shut down during our three most profitable months, and we're reopening at our least profitable months.
Yeah, yeah.
So you tacked on COVID to that and all the past expenses that you accrued, and it's tough. And we'll see. You know, I think a lot of us are hoping that they adjust this, but it's also, what do? Do you cut down on labor right now and hope that they're going to increase the forgivable period? So it's tough to try to navigate this. And I think there's not a one size fits all strategy for everyone. Everyone has to do what's in the best interest of their business and kind of figure out their own path and plan. So we have a plan that we're working, and, you know, we'll see where the chips fall. But at the end of the day, you know, the goal is for hopefully us and all the restaurants around us, we all survive in our industry, we can move forward. And it's just a black eye that we need to get over.
It is an enormous source of employment in South Florida. There's no doubt about it. Kevin, we appreciate you spending the time with us here on the Roundup. Thanks so much and best of luck.
Absolutely.
Kevin Danilow owns Batch Hospitality Group, 3 restaurants in Delray Beach, Miami, and West Palm. Mika, thanks for sharing your experience as well. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you guys so much for having me on today and you know, sharing light on what's going on in our industry.
Absolutely. Best of luck to you, your family, and your staff. Mika Leone, owner of Caja Caliente restaurant in Coral Gables. Finally, on the Roundup this week, South Florida is beginning to navigate this new normal, right? And we've been asking listeners to share some of their stories with us. And we heard from Fred Blevins in Lake Worth Beach. He sent us this voice memo.
I'm laid off indefinitely for my job, which was driving flight crews to and from Palm Beach International Airport and their hotels in Palm Beach County. I went on unemployment. Also a new normal. I'm also an adjunct professor at UM School of Communication and the FAU Honors College in Jupiter. my class at UM this semester suddenly went online at spring break, and that was a very new normal. At this point, we see friends in the neighborhood in Lake Worth. We live in the College Park neighborhood, and we cook more than ever before. I'm riding my bicycle more often and doing house projects that have been piling up for months, a few for years. Always distancing and always wearing a mask when out in the public.
Fred, we appreciate you sharing your story with us. So how about it, South Florida? What's your new normal look like? You can send us a text and share your story. Here's the text number, 786-677-0767. The text line here at WLR again, 786-677-0767. You can also find us on social media, all the platforms. There we are, WLR and Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and helping you keep track of the latest coronavirus news. You can sign up for our COVID newsletter at WLRN.org/coronavirus. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations at WLRN and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. The director of radio programming at WLRN is Jason Zapka. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.